Good morning and welcome to Highway 101. Scientists can argue the toss about when precisely the tipping point will be reached in terms of global climate change. That's the point of no return, when it will be too late to rectify the damage that we've done to our planet's atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. One person who's been trying to get people's attention focused on the subject for a couple of decades now is Professor Inez Fung, one of the world's leading atmospheric scientists. She was born in Hong Kong in 1949 and came to study in the USA at the age of 18. After graduating from MIT, she worked for the US National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Her main work has focused on producing climate models, which will help predict the effects of our continuing addiction to the exploitation of fossil fuels. Inez Fung, you're very welcome.
Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about your early life first and how you ended up taking the path that you did. You were born in one of the greatest cities in the world. So what was your experience of Hong Kong in the 50s when you were a small child there?
We lived near the beach. I remember the ocean. I remember the sky. I remember the waves. And I remember how the waves change before the hurricanes, before the typhoons came, and how the beach was different after the typhoon. And typhoons were a great thing for me because I didn't have to go to school when the typhoons came, so I knew all the signals, I knew what lights, what symbols, and so you look forward to the typhoon. And for a very, I think, stuffy childhood, typhoon was a time of great excitement.
And describe what it's like to me to be in the middle of a typhoon or to be sitting watching a typhoon from the, I suppose, the comfort and hopefully the safety of a house.
Well, the trees sway about and then the big drops, and I remember the drop size, big drops of rain, and it's just excitement, a lot of energy in the atmosphere. And when the eye comes over, it's like this dead calm. Like everyone holds silent, everyone holds his or her breath, and then the storms come, the winds come again. One year, the typhoon eye came over, and my brother and I ran in the calmness from our place down to the hospital where my grandmother was, and we made it.
And you talk about Hong Kong as a place of beaches and sea. I think of Hong Kong as a place of skyscrapers. I mean, I think you at some point you moved from the beach to the skyscrapers, didn't you?
But still, Hong Kong is a small place. You're surrounded by the sky and you're surrounded by the water. So whether you're down at the beach, I was in school, I was thinking about the beach all the time.
Was it a very lively place to grow up?
Oh, fantastic. It was just fantastic. But for a Chinese daughter, I didn't have too much freedom.
Yeah, you've described your parents as old-fashioned. What does that mean in a Chinese context?
I don't think I was ever alone in the entire time that I was growing up in Hong Kong. So we were somewhere with my sister and my brothers, or with my parents, or somewhere. I think I was supervised most of the time.
So privacy was something that you didn't experience much of as a child.
I don't think privacy is very much a Chinese value.
And is the extended family a Chinese value?
Oh, yes. My grandmother lived with us. I have cousins who lived with us. And so it's just part of my growing up that there are lots of people around. And it was very fun, very much fun. Except that I wasn't going anywhere by myself.
And school and home, I think, for you were two totally, totally different cultures, weren't they?
My grandmother was a Buddhist, and she lived with us. I would read her Buddhist mantras, and this was in Chinese, in Cantonese. But I went to an American Catholic school, not because of any religious reason, but because it was open-minded and it was a good school. So in the daytime, I spoke English and I recited Hail Marys, did the rosary, and I went home and I read Buddhist mantras in Chinese.
And did this induce any kind of sense of cultural schizophrenia in you?
No,
or was
no,
it just
no.
Normal?
It was just, to me now, I can describe it mathematically as a change in coordinate system. It really is no big deal. You are in one coordinate system or you're in the other coordinate system. You know exactly where you are.
Hmm.
You just have to be very precise, and you know what the rules are in one system and you know what the rules are in the other system.
And one of the rules very definitely in the school system was that you speak English or else it cost you, didn't it? Literally cost you.
My allowance was $10 Hong Kong a month, and Coca-Cola was 30 cents a bottle. And each Cantonese word they caught was 10 cents.
So if you were caught saying something in Cantonese, you were fined immediately?
Well, if they caught me speaking Cantonese and I say, "Aya," that's 20 cents.
So it doesn't take long to add up to $10.
It doesn't take long to have all my allowance gone.
So no soft drinks. How conscious would you have been when you were growing up of what was going on in communist China in the 1960s, for example?
We have family in China, and I was very much aware because of, not of the grand scale, but on a very small scale, that I would be writing letters for people who didn't know how to write, and they would be the letters would be written on cloth so that the cloth could be reused. And I would have to read, when letters came from China, I would be the kid who would be reading the letters, telling the people, the recipients who could not read, what was going on
with their families.
With their families. So I was not aware of the grand scale political situation, but I certainly was aware of the famines. And now, many years later, I realize I was in El Nino year. It was one of the bad El Nino years, but I didn't know at the time.
1997 was obviously going to be a very important year for Hong Kong. Was that the handover? Was that a concern for your family when you were growing up? I mean, you would have left Hong Kong 30 years before it happened. So was it very, very far in the distance?
I cannot speak for my parents because, being old-fashioned parents, they didn't tell me too many things. But I was aware in 1967, when there were riots in Hong Kong, we lived on Kennedy Road, which is at the same level as the Government House off Garden Road. And there were protesters, and they parked in front of our apartment building, and they got out of their cars, and they waved their little, and they started waving the red books right in front of our apartments. And that particular spring, I was home studying for my A-levels. So I watched the whole thing while I was home. And then there were riots, and we had curfews. And so I don't think I was still aware of the bigger political picture because I was a student. I went to American school, and Chinese history was a minor subject. I was not a great student. I experienced firsthand all the riots and watched the protesters in front of us.
Mm. And your last year of high school, I think you were plunged into a very male environment, weren't you? And you had quite a hard time.
Well, it was the last 2 years. I did my O-levels and my A-levels in what was nominally a boys' school. There were 13 girls in a school of 1,000 boys. So this is at the upper levels. There were very few women. And so it was a consolidation, very few women in sciences. So it was a consolidation of the public, the government school system, so that all the women interested in science, in the sciences, were admitted to, I think, one particular boys' school, government school.
And some of the boys there basically felt that you had taken a place that should have been taken by one of their friends.
Yes, because I think the sentiment at that time, and they were not the only one, was that women did not have careers outside of the home.
You were also a talented pianist in your youth. Did you ever think of that? Was there a time when maybe you might not have become a scientist, you might have become a professional musician?
Well, I dreamed of being a professional pianist. I was told I wasn't good enough, and now I understand that I'm not good enough. But at the age of 14, I didn't take that very kindly.
And what kind of music would you have been playing and listening to as a teenager? Would you have been playing one kind of music on piano and perhaps listening to a different kind of music? Or did you play and listen to the same kinds of music?
I play classical piano. I started when I was 5, and I finished all the exams of the Royal School of Music. But I certainly knew who the Beatles were. So I listened to everything.
Now, at the age of 18, you took what appears to be a courageous step as a teenager in coming to the USA. Was it a very, very tough decision to take, to leave your family and everything that you had known up to that point?
No, because as I said, I had now the word to use is bicultural upbringing, that I had gone to American school and I speak English. I watched Perry Mason. I did. So it was not such an alien move for me. And also because of the rioting that I saw in front of our apartment building, and my parents certainly were aware of that. They basically spent their early lives through several wars in China. So they were not in disagreement that I should go away.
They were afraid of what Hong Kong was going to become when you were a teenager, when you were in your teens.
Well, one looks for stability. Now I appreciate the sense of stability. And while I think it might have been exciting in a turbulent society, one still yearns for stability, especially for children to grow up in.
Yeah, USA was fairly turbulent in the 1960s when you came here as well. But so therefore, it wasn't a lonely, isolated life for you when you came here. You threw yourself into it pretty much straight away, did you?
I was surprised. We landed in San Francisco, and I was surprised how short the buildings were, that they were not many tall buildings like Hong Kong, that there was this large. What struck me all through my first year was the horizontalness of the U.S. compared to the vertical Hong Kong and the finiteness of Hong Kong versus what seemed like infinite space.
And at what point did you decide that you wanted to work in the area of climate and the area of atmospheric science?
I really didn't decide to do that. It's one of those marvelous things of one professor doing something and teaching something. And this was when I was an undergraduate in mathematics at MIT and solving equations. And I thought it was nice, but it was rather boring. And then one professor came and put some meaning to the equations. And then at the end of it, lo and behold, you can explain the continents moving away apart at 4 centimeters per year. And I thought this was absolutely marvelous. And not only that, he had toys. And this was in the years when Lorentz and the Chaos paper had just come out, not just, recently. Mm. And they had a little water table. And I remember they took the Lazy Susan off some professor's dining table. And they glued Dixie cups to the sides, and then they punched holes in the Dixie cups, and then they put it on a turntable, tilted turntable, and then they glued a beaker.
So it's like a Ferris wheel of cups.
It's a Ferris wheel of cups, but it had a beaker in the middle, and then there was this major discussion whether you need corn syrup or what oil, what viscosity you needed, etc. But what was marvelous was that there was a hose at the top of it. And when you ran the hose, then depending on how the flow rate from the hose versus the flow rate that the size of holes that were punched in the Dixie cups, either the water just dripped through and the wheel didn't move, or one side got more water than the other, and so the wheel turns. And what was spectacular was exactly like the equations, the wheel stops, and then it turns the other way. Mm. So here were the equations, which I can plow through, but here was this marvelous turning table with Dixie cups and corn syrup and everything. And it did everything the equation said it might do.
It's a strange way to get into climate science. Now, you got married around the time you got your PhD, and you thought that you and your husband, Jim, were going to live together in New York, and you were going to work for NASA. It didn't quite work out like that when you actually got to New York.
Well, we got an apartment, and then I arrived at work and said, here I am, We're here, we settled in, I'm ready to work. And they say, oh, we're moving to Maryland. And they thought that was great. And of course, they thought I would share in their enthusiasm.
Not likely, seeing as though you just got married and you just moved into an apartment and now you were going to be basically living or working a couple of hundred miles away from your husband.
Well, it is not just the issue of living in two cities. It was also the issue of what would I do, what kind of work would I be doing. And for me, Maryland was also another surprise, because I grew up in city, and Boston is a big city, and I was looking for another, New York. And Maryland was the suburbs, and I didn't know how to live in the suburbs, to commute, to have to drive to work, and all the things that people do, but I didn't know how to do, because I had no experience.
And what were you doing for NASA? Because, again, we associate NASA with space exploration and space research, but you were researching our own planet.
There were weather satellites. So the building of weather satellites and the testing all starts with NASA before they hand it to NOAA in operational fashion. So at NASA at the time, it was at the beginning of the era when the satellite observations of the atmosphere were incorporated into weather forecast models. So it's a huge program with mathematics and with modeling to say how do you assimilate, ingest the weather data.
Now, you worked with a couple of people who I think perhaps in retrospect will be seen as pioneers in increasing international awareness, but first of all, American awareness, national awareness of climate change, and that's Jule Charney and Jim Hansen. Would you tell me a little bit about what they did and how they began to make people aware of global warming?
Jule Charney was my thesis advisor. In 1950, he led the first numerical weather forecast experiment ever that was successful, and that was done on a 10-word computer, an ENIAC computer that had 10-word memory. It took them over a month to make the successful forecast, and it was a very limited domain over the U.S. only. It was only one level in the vertical, average in the vertical. And what Charney succeeded in doing was basically doing the theoretical work to say what are the important wave motions in the atmosphere, that, you know, what are the storms and what are the not critical wave motions in the atmosphere. And so he did the equations, he filtered the equations so that the not important waves were no longer bothering the mathematics. So it was a really brilliant move. And so with my thesis, I actually had to learn to program a computer rather than doing analytical mathematics.
And this was a computer the size of a room, presumably.
Yes, but when I was a student, you know, they have gotten smaller. But this was MIT, and so to learn to program, they thought I should know how the computer works, not just how to send it instructions. So they created an artificial machine language, and I had to, and all you do is to type in numbers. So there's a code for A, a code for B, a code for a space.
Is this ones and zeros all the time?
No. So it's not ones and zeros. Right. It's kinder than ones and zeros, but but it goes from 01 to 37. And so if you wish to type an equation, then you have to look up the code for everything. And this is in the era of punch cards, and there's no way to check except by typing it again and lining up the holes to see if the holes lined up. And I went to the professor and I said, can I just tell you the logic? Must I do this?
Yes, you must.
And the answer is yes, you must. But it was very informative because you have to move a number or a variable into a particular register and then operate on numbers inside the register and then move the answers back out, et cetera, et cetera. So really help me visualize when I'm running huge computer codes how the numbers are flying around in memory.
And Jim Hansen was somebody who brought the attention, I think, of the U.S. Senate and of government to the issue of global change.
But what Charney did in 1979 was to convene a meeting, the National Academy of Sciences meeting, to look at the climate, to look at global warming. So at the time, there were only two global atmospheric circulation models that had done that calculation. One was at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton, and the other was done by Jim Hansen. And they gave very different results, and this was 1979. They gave very different results, which still hold. You know, at the time, Charney reported that for doubling CO2, we expect, and if you wait forever for the system to come into equilibrium, we expect about 1.5 degrees to or slightly over 4 degrees warming Celsius. That number still holds.
Yeah,
and the difference between the Hansen calculation and the Manabe, this is at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab, the other calculation was how the assumptions they made about how clouds might respond to climate change. And that's still an open question.
Now, tell me about the mystery of the missing carbon dioxide that you uncovered in the 1990s.
When you look at the atmospheric CO2 record, and then you look at the year-by-year increase in atmospheric CO2 burden, and you say how much fossil fuel CO2 did we emit into the atmosphere, it turns out that the atmosphere absorbs, you know, about half of what got emitted. So the rest has gone into the ocean, into the land. Up to that point, the assumption was that the oceans would be the repository for the 50% that's not in the atmosphere. So that's based on a lot of ocean calculations and ocean chemistry. What we did was we looked at the difference between the northern hemisphere, the CO2 gradient between northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere. So it's only 1%, it's not that big a deal, nobody really cares about it. But when we looked at the north-south difference, then we thought that if the oceans had to be the only repository for that CO2.
There's a lot more water in the southern hemisphere.
Then there's a lot more water in the southern hemisphere, and that really would exaggerate the north-south difference, the hemispheric difference in the atmosphere, to way beyond what is observed.
So where did you find this missing carbon dioxide?
Well, we didn't find it. We just said this is sort of like Hercule Poirot to say, It cannot be here, it cannot be there, it cannot be there, and the most likely place is in the northern hemisphere land, the terrestrial biosphere. And that was a little bit controversial because all my friends called me up and said, I'm just helping you. You made a major mistake. And I said, most likely, but please show me the data that proves that I made a mistake, and no data were available.
But where does it disappear? We don't know where it disappears to. I mean, it's not being absorbed. Is it being absorbed by trees?
Of it is by trees, and so this is sort of like you put out a Christmas play, and there are lots of children who could star in it. Which one? So what we know now is that it's a whole combination of factors. So it's not like a single factor. So in North America, there's abandonment of agriculture, and so there's regrowth of forests, and that's storing some carbon. There is there's regrowth of forests. There's a controversy of whether the CO2 is fertilizing the trees or not, and I won't go into that. The data are not clear either way. But also with the changes in the vegetation types, especially in the Southwest, woody encroachment. So there could be little things that add up.
Mm. Talk a little bit about that IPCC report. You've been knocking on the door for many years now, trying to alert people to global warming, to climate change. Then it seemed this year that that report burst the door wide open. Tell me a little bit about the process of compiling that report and why you think it, I suppose, it scared people.
I'm a contributing author to the IPCC report. And the reports, this is the fourth report, and it comes out approximately every 5 years. The last one was 2001. For us, there's the theoretical basis of climate change. And we've been saying the same thing, CO2. You know the molecular structure of CO2, it's just standard physics. The CO2 absorbs energy in the particular sets of wavelengths. Water vapor is also a greenhouse gas, and here are the wavelengths where water vapor absorbs energy. All those things we know, we've known for a long time, and so we know with the addition of CO2 to the atmosphere, then there would be absorption of energy, then there would be warming, and that would cause evaporation. More water vapor in the atmosphere, that would cause melting of snow so that the ground becomes darker and there's more absorption of sunlight, and that also contributes to warming. And then there are these clouds. While it's nice to think about clouds in poetry, it is really difficult to write equations to predict them. And so the clouds act to dampen the warming. But the degree to which they dampen depends on where they hang out, whether they get taller, whether they the three-dimensional distribution of clouds. So we've been saying the same thing. But fortunately or unfortunately for us, the warmest 6 years in the last 200 years of instrumental record are 1998, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. So with a run like that, it is very difficult to say, not just here is the theory, to stop at the theory, the evidence is here. So it's very difficult for anyone to ignore the evidence. And I think this is part of the reason it pains us so much, because when the evidence is here, it is getting very late. So Jim Henson, with whom I worked for many years, said in 1988, and this is from his analysis of the temperature record, that he was confident that the human-induced greenhouse effect was here. But the evidence was just beginning to come in, and it's not as compelling as what has happened in the last several years.
And what about the argument, which is put out, for example, that humans are not causing climate change, that it's sunspots, for example?
Well, sunspots, for example, do not have a run like that. That sunspots cannot explain why the last several years are the hottest 6 years in the last 200 years have a run in recent memory.
Hmm. Now, given what we've already done to the atmosphere as human beings, what's the best result that we can expect in terms of temperature increases that are going to happen in the years ahead, no matter what measures, what mitigating measures that we take in the years ahead?
We have already committed another, I'm going to say, close to 1 degree Celsius.
And there is nothing we can do about that.
There is nothing we can do. And this is why we are concerned, because this is a long-term problem, that the CO2 in the atmosphere is going to cause the oceans to warm, and the oceans are going to evaporate more water, and the water vapor is a greenhouse gas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So even if we, by some magic, keep the CO2 constant at today's concentration, we still have yet another close to 1 Celsius warming in the pipeline.
And we're not going to do that. So
And we said that. And what pains me is that we wrote a paper in the early 80s. We called it unrealized warming. Now we call it committed warming, but it's the same thing, that the ocean is a huge thermal, has huge thermal inertia, and there's more in the pipeline.
Okay, so we've got 1 degree whether we like it or not. If, as California, for example, is attempting to do, as the European Union is attempting to do, we reduce greenhouse gas emissions by, say, 20% over the next 10 or 15 years, what's that going to do for us? Are we going to get another 1 degree on top of that, or
yes,
2 degrees? We are, definitely.
We are.
Now, explain to me, 2 degrees does not sound like a huge difference in terms of temperature. What's it going to do? What effect is it going to have?
2 degrees will be seen not as a slow increase. slow warming of 2 degrees, but there'll be more severe weather, more severe heat waves, droughts, floods, as well as snowstorms.
Ocean levels, will they rise?
Ocean levels will rise because there is thermal expansion.
Because I've been listening to the debate in the USA, and you hear people ringing into, you know, phoning into programs and saying, hey, look, you know, the climate in America, in the United States of America, will actually improve in, you know, in Minnesota, for example. It'll be warmer in the wintertime. We'll be able to grow more crops. I mean, do you think that that is a kind of a mindset that people are getting into in this part of the world?
I won't speak for all people, but I think that the reminder is that while the climate may be more habitable for humans, the climate may also be more habitable for certain pests. And so it may be simple to say crops may grow better, but so would the pests for crops.
George Bush is seen as a recent convert to climate change. His State of the Union address this year, he recognized it perhaps for the first time. He's been criticized for his policy. You're shaking your head. Why are you shaking your head? You don't think he's a convert? No.
In 2001, after the third IPCC report came out, the White House asked the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to answer some questions about climate change. And I was part of that group, and we wrote the report that said that the climate change is, you know, temperatures increasing, CO2 rising, and it's mostly likely in 2001 caused by human activities. And what surprised us, that spring, summer, we wrote the report in May, and there was a Rose Garden speech in June in which the president said that global warming is a serious problem. However, in the February 2002, the Clear Sky speech, he said that the uncertainty is so great, scientists really don't know.
Even though you told them.
Well, so this is where the issue of language becomes very confusing, especially for me. What was said was that while the problem is serious, the solution path is not clear.
One of the solutions that he has offered is, for example, in terms of transportation, that ethanol, biofuels, ethanol, for example, can be used as an alternative to petroleum. Is there a potential cure there, or is the cure as bad as the disease?
I think you cannot look at quick cures. You have to look at what it costs, how is ethanol produced? What is the energy requirement to produce ethanol? And at the end of all that calculation, I don't think ethanol is that attractive.
So in other words, it takes almost as much energy to produce ethanol as ethanol actually saves you in terms of global warming.
Yes.
And then there's the added problem of water. Nuclear energy. Is nuclear energy a solution?
With nuclear energy, the challenge is dealing with the waste. And I think the global warming challenge is to the industry to work for a better way, a safer way to deal with the waste.
I talked at the beginning of the program about a tipping point. How close are we to that tipping point, the point where it is already too late, no matter what measures are taken? Are we 5 years away from it, 10 years, 20, 50, 100? Do you have any idea from the kind of modelling that you're doing at the moment?
Unfortunately for us, where we are wrong with the models is in the wrong direction. I'll explain. The melting glaciers on Greenland is something that we did not capture on the models.
You weren't ready for that particular eventuality.
It was a piece of physics that we were not aware of. We thought, how would glaciers melt? They sort of slowly disappear into the atmosphere. What we were not prepared for were the moulins, these rivers in the snow, and that that appear to
it's
destabilizing the glaciers. The surface is getting darker faster than we had predicted.
So it's absorbing more sun.
It's absorbing more sun, and so the warming is happening faster than we had predicted. The other thing is the calculations that I did where we put in an interactive carbon cycle into the climate model. And in those calculations, you know, when I said half the fossil fuel CO2 is in the land and in the ocean, from our calculations, with a warmer world, the land, both the land and the oceans, can hold less carbon.
So they are emitting more carbon
dioxide.
They're
emitting more carbon dioxide. That means that climate is going to warm faster than we had predicted.
So your gut instinct is that the tipping point is a lot closer than you had thought maybe 5-6 years ago.
Yes. I think we have to take it as quickly as possible. I think tomorrow is too late.
Is there an inevitability that human short-sightedness is going to win out, that people will still want their cars, will still want their air conditioning, will still want their gadgets and their gizmos, and that world climate is going to change to our detriment? Are you an optimist or are you a pessimist?
I'm an optimist, especially because I'm here at the University of California. I'm in California and I'm at Berkeley. Because at the Lawrence Berkeley lab up the hill, they thought about the climate problem a long time ago. And if you imagine the energy efficiency of refrigerators today versus what they were 20 years ago, there's been tremendous improvement. There could be tremendous improvement in all the gadgets that we use and the cars that we drive. The technology is available. There, you compare a Prius, a hybrid vehicle, versus an SUV, fuel efficiency is achievable today. At the end of it is money. And at the end of it, I think that there could be money made from green technology. There could be new jobs created from green technology. There could be a new industry. If all TVs in China were the most efficient television, if all cars in China were the most energy efficient cars, and if every refrigerator is the most efficient, energy-efficient refrigerator we have today, I think we could save a lot of energy.
But that's going to take a lot more than 2 or 3 years to bring about, isn't it? I mean, that's going to take 10, 15, 20 years for that.
Look at the market development in China, I think things could happen a lot faster if there's the will, if there's the incentive.
If people listening to this program were to say, well, what can I, as an individual, what can I do? What can I do in my home? What can I do in terms of changing my habits to help bring about the kind of positive change that we're talking about in the context of climate?
The first thing is to be less wasteful. I think that we equate standard of living with not having to worry about what I do with one side of paper. You know, I write on one side of the paper and not two sides, and lights on in the hallway. A lot of things, wasteful things, we can easily do very quickly.